Throughout the book of Exodus and Numbers, God's leaders played a central role in representing him before the people. Chief among them was Moses, but unfortunately, he and those associated with him, such as Aaron, faced opposition pretty much from the beginning. Today, we're going to explore the rebellion of Korah and how God vindicated Moses and Aaron. And we're going to conclude by looking at Aaron's rod that budded and see how the original Hebrew gives us some very interesting insights. Join me for this episode of All Things Apostolic. Before we examine the rebellion of Korah, it's important to always look at Bible stories in their larger context. What was happening in Israel in this time period? Well, between the rescue from Egypt and the acquisition of the Promised Land, Israel spent 40 years in the wilderness, with periods of being in conflict with God. In fact, when Moses was giving his final speech to the people in the book of Deuteronomy, he said, "Remember and forget not how thou provokest the Lord thy God to wrath in the wilderness, from the day that thou didst depart out of the land of Egypt until ye came unto this place. Ye have been rebellious against the Lord." Multiple times Israel tested God, beginning back in Exodus with issues like being stuck at the edge of the sea while Pharaoh's army approached, the bitter water, hunger, disobeying the command to eat all of the manna daily, and disobeying the command to gather enough manna for the seventh day, and many more. And the climax in Exodus came with the golden calf incident. In the book of Numbers, the cycle of complaining and rebellion continued. In the middle of the book is an especially dark period in which there were seven times of testing or rebellion. In chapter 11, there was some general testing at the beginning in the form of complaining. Later in that chapter, the people were dissatisfied with the manna and wanted meat to eat. Chapter 12 was Aaron's and Miriam's challenge to Moses' leadership. Chapters 13 and 14 marked Israel's fatal mistake of complaining about their ability or inability to secure the Promised Land. This particular rebellion meant that there would be a shift from the Exodus generation to the conquest generation. In chapter 16 and 17, we again have a leadership crisis when Korah and others rebelled against Moses and Aaron. Chapter 20 documents Israel's complaint about a lack of water. And in chapter 21, again Israel tested God by complaining why he had brought them out of the land of Egypt to die in the wilderness with no food and water and only the manna that they hated. Against this backdrop of testing and rebellion against God, we have Korah's rebellion against God's appointed leaders. Korah was a Levite, and more specifically, a Kohathite, the ones who were responsible for transporting the items in the tabernacle, including the Ark of the Covenant, as Israel traveled in the wilderness from place to place. So the Kohathites had a special role. Korah was joined by others in his rebellion, 250 princes of the assembly, famous men of renown in the congregation. They included Levites who were supposed to be the spiritual leaders, and also Dathan and Abiram, who descended from Reuben, who represented authority as the eldest brother of the 12 tribes. They were also part of the rebellion. So Korah argued that everyone had an equal right to participate in the priesthood. Numbers 16:3 says, "And they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron, and said unto them, Ye take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Wherefore then lift you up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord? They basically challenged Moses' authority and Aaron's role as the high priest. And the main problem is that Moses and Aaron were chosen by God. Watchman Nee, in his book on spiritual authority, says that God and his delegated authority are inseparable. In order to be in subjection to God, they had to be in subjection to the authority of Moses and Aaron. But the people didn't mention God or his commandment. They thought that they were only opposing Moses and Aaron. But when a person rejects God's delegated authority, it is basically a rejection of God. So how did Moses respond? Well, he didn't lift himself up. Rather, he fell on his face. Then he told Korah and his company to take censers and burn incense in them the next day. And the Lord would choose who was holy. God would make his choice known by the acceptance or rejection of the incense offerings. Then Moses concluded by turning their words around on them and saying, "Ye take too much upon you, ye sons of Levi." In verse 9, he said, "Seemeth it but a small thing unto you that the God of Israel hath separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself to do the service of the tabernacle of the Lord and to stand before the congregation to minister unto them? And he hath brought thee near to him and all thy brethren, the sons of Levi, with thee. And seek ye the priesthood also?" Korah was ungrateful for the special position that he had. Instead, he wanted more power and authority. But Moses let them know that they were really acting against the Lord. Then Moses sent for Dathan and Abiram because they were not present, but they refused to come. And then they grumbled about being taken away from a land flowing with milk and honey into a wilderness where Moses could be a prince over them. They complained that they had not been brought into the land flowing with milk and honey, and they had not received their inheritance of fields and vineyards. Basically, they wanted material prosperity, and they were blaming Moses that it had not happened. Now, that made Moses mad because he was being falsely accused. And he prayed to God to not accept their offering. It was their own fault that they had not entered into the promised land. And ultimately, their complaint showed a lack of faith in God's promise. The next morning, Korah gathered all the congregation against Moses and Aaron at the door of the tabernacle. God threatened to consume all of the congregation. But Moses and Aaron fell on their faces and pleaded with God. Remember that the Israelites had repeatedly tempted God with murmuring and other issues, and God in his long suffering had forgiven them. But this time, God was prepared to judge their rebellion. Then God told Moses to tell all the people to separate themselves away from Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, lest the congregation be consumed in their sins. Then Moses said that if the men die a common death like all people, then that will confirm that the Lord did not send him. But if the Lord does a new thing and the earth swallows them up, then that will confirm that Moses was sent by the Lord. So let's pause for a moment here. When God threatened to consume all of the people, Moses cried out to him, saying, "O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh," meaning that he is the God of mankind. Moses was acknowledging God as the creator and sustainer of all life. Then Moses showed great courage when he said that God would either vindicate him or the rebel leaders. He described what God would do, and it involved opening the earth to swallow up the rebels. Moses demonstrated his faith in God's sovereign power over the created world. Moses knew that God was capable of doing it, and God responded to Moses' words by having the earth swallow up Korah and his family, his associates, and his possessions. And it came to pass, as he had made an end of speaking all these words, that the ground clave asunder that was under them, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed them up, and their houses, and all the men that appertained unto Korah, and all their goods, they and all that appertained to them, went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed upon them, and they perished from the congregation. Then fire came from the Lord and consumed the 250 men who had offered incense. God judged the rebels, vindicating Moses and Aaron, while also confirming their delegated authority and his ultimate authority. Now, you would think that the Israelites would have learned their lesson, but instead, they again murmured against Moses and Aaron, blaming them for killing the people of the Lord. They called the rebellious ones the people of the Lord. As the congregation again gathered against Moses and Aaron at the tabernacle, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. The Lord told Moses that he was going to consume the congregation. Moses discerned that a plague was breaking out. He told Aaron to quickly make atonement for the people, which Aaron did. But still, 14,700 people died in the plague before it was stopped. There are several lessons from Numbers chapter 16. First, there were two instances of rebellion. The first was the leaders, which is addressed in verses 1 through 40. And the second is the whole congregation in verses 41 through 50. The ground swallowing Korah and his group, and the fire consuming the 250 people holding the censers, was God's judgment on the rebellion of the leaders. But it didn't quell the rebellious spirit among the people. We know that they were still rebellious because they accused Moses of killing their leaders. The supernatural events that they witnessed the day before did not put the fear of God into them. A really sobering thought is that rebellious people can be so bold that they don't fear God even after seeing his judgment. And this also shows that rebellion is contagious. It can spread amongst a congregation. Perhaps that's why God judged it. 10 times the people had murmured and God showed forbearance. But with rebellion against his authority and against his delegated authority, he immediately judged it. Rebellion is very contagious and it leads down a pathway to death. A lesson from this story that Watchman Nee highlights is that the complaint by Dathan and Abiram about being in the wilderness was true. It was a difficult environment, and they felt like what they had left in Egypt was better than where they were at. And now they had no hope of entering the promised land. So it was kind of a reasonable complaint, considering the circumstances. But they had lost access to go to the promised land because of their unbelief. They reasoned that they couldn't conquer the land. But we don't enter the promised land based on reason. We enter based on faith. Watchman Nee says it this way: he who walks after reason and sight goes the way of reason. Only he who obeys authority enters Canaan by faith. Following the rebellion of Korah, chapter 17 presents a very interesting situation. Instead of the people testing God, God decided to set up a test. God was going to explicitly show his divine endorsement of Aaron to convince the people that he had appointed Aaron and that he expected the people to accept Aaron in that position. God commanded each one of the heads of the tribes to bring a rod inscribed with his name. And for the tribe of Levi, Aaron's name was written on the rod. Just to clarify, the Hebrew word for rod can also be translated as a staff, shaft, or a branch. The rods were placed in the tabernacle overnight. By the next morning, the rod with Aaron's name on it had come to life. It had budded, blossomed, and brought forth almonds. Even the original Hebrew gives us a beautiful poetic parallelism using alliteration, which is a repetition of sound. Specifically, the sound of the Hebrew consonant tsadi, which kind of makes a ts, a TS sound. The end of the verse, which says that Aaron's rod put forth buds and produced blossoms, sounds like vayotze, perach, vayatzetz, tzitz. That is a tongue twister. The Hebrew kind of bursts with this poetic sound to highlight what the Creator has done. But think about this. Not only did Aaron's rod sprout, but it bore ripened almonds overnight. This is, again, a remarkable demonstration of God's power over His creation. And it reminds me of God's creation of Adam. God is capable of creating things that are already mature. So something that may appear millions of years old, just like the earth, doesn't necessarily mean that it took millions of years to develop, because God is Lord over all the creation. This miracle of the budding rod related to Aaron and the high priest position in two ways. First, the staff on which Aaron's name was inscribed, or the rod, put forth almond buds and blossoms. The Hebrew word is perach. The lamps in the tabernacle, which the high priest took care of, were shaped like perach, almond flowers with buds and blossoms. Second, the Hebrew word tzitz refers to the collective blossoms produced by Aaron's rod. And elsewhere in Exodus and Leviticus, the same word tzitz is used for the rosette that decorated the front of the high priest's turban. So there was a correlation between the almond rod and the high priest's role. God told Moses to keep the rod as a sign to the rebellious people so they would stop grumbling against God and not die. Aaron's rod was meant as a reminder and as a warning. And it seems pretty gentle, right? Just preserving a blossoming almond staff. Oh, but there's significance to almonds that makes this more understandable. The Hebrew word for almond is shaked. It is derived from the same root as the Hebrew verb shakad, which means to be watchful or awake. This description applied well to almond trees because they were watchful and awake in the sense that they were the first trees to blossom every year while the other trees were still resting from winter. Now, this also helps us to understand God's object lesson to Jeremiah when he was young. God was commissioning Jeremiah to be a prophet, and Jeremiah resisted by saying that he couldn't do it because he was just a child. God touched Jeremiah's mouth and assured Jeremiah that he put words in Jeremiah's mouth. Jeremiah chapter 1, verses 11 to 12 then says, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Jeremiah, what seest thou? And I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. Then said the Lord unto me, Thou hast well seen, for I will hasten my word to perform it." Jeremiah saw the rod or branch of an almond tree. Again, it's the Hebrew word shaked. And then God used a form of the verb shakad to say that basically he was watching to see that his word was fulfilled. God used an almond rod to reassure Jeremiah that he would be with him and awake and watching to make his word come to pass. So the almond rod with Aaron implied not only God's power over creation and his designation of Aaron as his chosen high priest, but the almond rod also symbolized God's watchfulness to guard his priesthood, because God is awake and never sleeps. Just like the almond blossom-shaped lamps in the tabernacle that Aaron and his sons were diligently to keep burning every night from evening to morning. God is vigilant and watchful, and he is always looking out for his designated leaders. In a sense, the wilderness was like a crucible for Israel, like a container used to melt metals and remove impurities by subjecting them to very high temperatures. The wilderness contained severe trials meant to purify Israel. And a key lesson that the Israelites had to learn is that it is a serious thing to challenge leaders who God has ordained. God completely vindicated Moses and Aaron before the people who had doubted the word of the Lord, murmured against Moses and Aaron as being self-appointed, and who believed that they themselves were qualified to hold the office. This story shows that personal ambition and qualifications are not valid reasons for challenging God's appointed leaders. We know that Aaron was not better than anyone else. In fact, he was the one who had spearheaded the incident with the golden calf. But he was chosen by God, and by being God's delegated authority, God watched over him, protected him, and helped him to be fruitful in his ministry. God expects us to recognize his chosen leaders. To oppose God's delegated authority is to oppose God. To submit ourselves to God's delegated authority is to submit to God. I hope you enjoy this episode and see you next time. God bless.